On this week's program, a conversation with storyteller James Brawley about his one-man show, Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Hour, now at the Bulma Theatre in Philadelphia. Susan Lewis takes us to two exhibitions at the National Constitution Centre that explore the real George Washington. And Eric Brannan profiles William T. Trigo. The Michener Museum in Doylestown is hosting the first ever retrospective of this little-remembered Pennsylvania Victorian-era painter. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
The latest production at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia documents the ups and downs of two decades of marriage, with love and death as the starting point for a one-man show based on the writer's real-life experiences. When James Brawley asked his terminally ill sister if she would like to trade places with him, she declined. She decided she would rather die than be in his marriage. Thus begins Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Hour, a dark comedic monologue of the life lessons Brawley has gleaned from 20 years of marriage to his one-time college sweetheart. When I met with James Brawley, I first asked him when he had begun writing first-person stories and what had come before.
We talk about the voice in writing, and in your case, the voice in writing is also the voice that delivers the material. Have you ever created material in any other way other than for your own voice? And if so, how is it different from writing for your own voice?
I was a corporate speechwriter for many, many years with people who, none of whom are famous, or most of whom are not famous. But after years of that, you know, one of the kind of inchoate voices that I was hearing was, you should be your own client. You know, you should start writing for yourself. And I'd always known that I wanted to write for myself, but I'd kind of given it up for various reasons. And I was writing pop songs, and I had a studio down in Soho. I had a recording studio on one wall and a writing studio on the other, and a rolling chair in the middle, and was literally rolling back and forth between writing the songs and writing speeches and the occasional kind of sketch or story, and back and forth and back and forth. But the, you know, the writing paid the bills and the music did not. And I could not sort of figure out where my heart was.
Or where you were in all of this process, yeah, I suspect.
Yeah, I'd gotten kind of, you know, I'd lost my way. I had a dark night, or possibly 3 weeks of the soul. First, I went to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist said, yeah, not a mental health issue, can't help you. If you wake up with a gun underneath your pillow, come back. And I was like, all right, okay, so I'm on my own. Long story short, stumbled one night into The Moth at Joe's Pub, which is part of the Public Theater in downtown New York. And there was a storytelling group doing extemporaneous stories, 10, 12, 14 minutes long. And that was the beginning for me. I thought, this is how I can actually do what I love to do and develop it.
You found home.
I'd found home. Yeah, I found my community. I'd found my forum.
So let me ask you then, how much of your storytelling is about your own emotional availability and how much of it is about your practiced craft of storytelling? I mean, there's two ways you can do it. You can either be truthful or you can be incredibly creative, and you hopefully convince people with either technique, right?
My conceit was it had to happen. You know, there's a couple of rules. It had to happen. I will collapse time. It may be that a phone call turns into a live conversation in the retelling, but it generally had to happen, and I won't reveal your secrets. I will reveal my secrets.
Right, but isn't that the art of the storyteller? Never let the truth interfere with a good story. I mean, at some point, it does need to become slightly fictional.
I was performing one night in a show in New York where there are four storytellers. Three of them are supposedly telling true stories, and one is telling a lie, which is only known to the producer of this show. And I have developed an audience who understands that what I'm telling them is true, or they think that what I'm telling them is true. That night, I was telling the lie. They didn't know that. It was very, very awkward. It's much more comfortable, maybe this is why I'm a performer, it's much more comfortable to lie in real life than it is to lie on stage.
Did they believe you?
Yes. Many did. Many did believe me.
And those who didn't, how were they certain that you were lying? And if so, how did they know, or did they tell you?
Those who didn't, it's interesting. There was one or two, the one actual, you know, there were one or two salient details which were true that I built into the story. And they said, there's no way you were capable of doing that. There's no way. And they voted me down for that. They thought it was a lie just for that, which was the truthful part of the story. But it got me caught out because that was my ego.
But a lot of the time, the more ridiculous the arc of a story is, a lot of the time, the more authentic it appears, because there's that, nobody could have made that up. This show, nobody could have made this up.
It had different manifestations, let's say, different incarnations. And one of the incarnations, I'm performing one night, and somebody who knew the details of my life walked up to me afterwards, and she kind of got up to my ear, and she said, "Who are you kidding?" And I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "You know, I know what's really going on. So you have to cop to the truth of your life because it's not resonating as truthful right now." So ultimately, I had to come around to a place where I started to treat my life as a beat reporter. And I'm actually going to ruthlessly, honestly report on this situation no matter what.
That sounds like the obsessed actor. You know, the actor who, after his mother dies, looks in the mirror and says, "Oh, interesting, that's what grief looks like."
I don't know if I'm that psychotic, but I could probably have a drink with that guy. and he might treat me to it. I
didn't get that far, though, that you were observing your life then.
Yes, and that's what goes back to what I was telling you before. You have to be very careful to draw the line between this is my life and this is me reporting on my life. Am I doing things in my life so that I can report on them? That's where you start to go crazy. You know what? I think I will actually cut off my toe or cause some horrific scene just to find out what happens and then report upon it. That's somebody who's driven to an unhealthy degree by the desire to tell a story that could not have happened to anybody else, kind of consciously. Whereas I like to think my objective is, or my, you know, intention is to wade into the terrain of romantic / familial love, but primarily romantic love, which is, you know, everybody's experienced in one way or the other. Oftentimes it's confusing. If it weren't, half of marriages would not end in divorce. Well, let me put it another way. I don't necessarily know what I'm doing. And it's a confusing terrain, emotional terrain. And so that's what I'm trying to report upon, honestly.
But I would imagine that gave you an enormous degree of freedom to make that admission that I don't actually know what this life is supposed to be or how I'm supposed to live it. And that's fine.
It gave me enormous creative freedom. There were domestic repercussions. You know, at one point you again, you know, as I was counseled that night at the theater, I had to make a choice. What matters more? Preserving this relationship no matter what, or telling a story that I think is worth telling no matter what.
But you still have to keep the idea of not revealing other people's secrets, right?
That's right. That's the ultimate kind of limiting factor. I'm not going to tell anybody anything that you wouldn't tell them. I will tell them stuff that I may not have told you. You may find out while I'm on stage for the first time that I've hated that cranberry sauce all these 30 Thanksgivings. And what do you mean? You said you loved it. No, I hate it. Or whatever it is that I have not revealed to you over time. But they're my secrets and I can say whatever I want to. I'm just not going to tell people what you wouldn't tell them or what you haven't already told enough people so that it's out there, which is the code that I follow.
So to an extent, there's an element of people hearing about aspects of their own life by reading about them in the newspaper. In your case, your wife / girlfriend hearing about very important parts of her own life from a stage. How often does she go to see you?
She's never seen it. she's heard about it. There are many grapes on the grapevine. And I did not want her to see it for years because I was developing the material and developing the way in which I delivered the material, you know, the voice, which is as essential as the material itself.
If the lady who's involved in this 20 years of marriage, your partner in this endeavor, were to see it in full as it is now, what do you think she would do?
I think she would realize that primarily it's self-deprecating, that the butt of most of the jokes is me and that she's rendered with largely with love and respect, in addition to stupefying otherness. Because she really is, as the show reveals, and ultimately I think this is what happens in a lot of marriages, you wake up one day and you look at somebody and you think, who are you? And how did we get here? What do you mean you want to, you know, quit your job at the investment bank and do watercolors and live in a bungalow in Idaho? I thought you wanted to live in the city with a Parkview apartment working 18-hour days for the next 35 years. I don't think I want to live in a bungalow in Idaho watching you paint watercolors. So one of the themes in the marriage, in the piece, is how you reconcile or not these profound differences between two people, which can happen anytime. And then the larger theme of the piece is, if you want to understand how you got there, go home. Because, you know, a lot of people think you can't go home again. The underlying conceit of the piece is you can't not go home again. If you want to understand why you're here, go there and take a long look.
James Brawley, his one-man show, Life in a Marital Institution, 20 Years of Monogamy in One Terrifying Hour, is at the Wilma Theatre in Philadelphia, Tuesday through Saturday until July 16th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
A number of historic sites in Philadelphia have a connection with America's first president and are now part of what has been called the Summer of Washington. Spearheading this initiative is the National Constitution Center, where two exhibitions consider George Washington through two of his households, Mount Vernon, Virginia, and the President's House in Philadelphia. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at the man behind the legend.
Under the leafy branches of a tree stands a tall young man, his skin fair, his eyes blue, his red hair tied back. This life-sized representation of the teenage George Washington was created through anthropological research and computer technology, using objects like a 1785 life mask from his estate at Mount Vernon, Virginia, where Laura Simo is curator of collections.
Using the bust, the life mask, we also have the dentures. Measurements of those, for example, were taken to give a sense of, you know, what did he exactly look like?
The model, created for an educational facility at Mount Vernon that opened in 2006, is one of three in the current traveling exhibition at the National Constitution Center. There's also the 45-year-old general on his white horse at Valley Forge, and the 57-year-old president taking the oath of office in New York City. Yet what George Washington looked like is less a puzzle than the rest of his story. After all, his image from a 1797 portrait by Gilbert Stuart graces every U.S. dollar bill. National Constitution Center President David Eisner says within decades of the president's death, the legend began eclipsing the man.
Within a couple of years, the legend of him chopping down the cherry tree, which was a complete fabrication, was created.
Mythologizing a national hero like Washington may be understandable, but understanding his life, his values, and his humanity is equally important today, says Eisner.
People forget how incredible it was that he gave up power twice, first as the all-powerful general and then as the all-powerful president. When people wanted him to take authoritarian, in some case royal power.
But how to know the man behind the legend? Curator of collections Laura Simo says aside from his writings,
to me, the real way to get to a person is to look at their stuff, the material culture of their life. How often do we write about ourselves, for example, but what we own, what we carry, what we wear, how we look, the objects that we surround ourselves with can tell us, in some cases, so much more than the written word can.
The Mount Vernon Ladies Association, which for more than 150 years has been preserving the first president's Virginia home and reacquiring possessions that were scattered, has organized this exhibition of paintings and decorative art, wax figures, architectural models, manuscripts, and other artifacts. The approximately 100 objects include many which were owned and used by the Washingtons. For example, a math workbook.
Washington's teaching himself here, in some cases some very complex pre-calculus level mathematics. And it's the earliest known book to have Washington's signature on the title page. We also have tablewares and dinnerwares that the Washingtons entertained with here in Philadelphia. These dishes, these pieces of silver, that's telling us something about the taste of the nation and where George Washington was trying to set precedence for other presidents and others in the United States to follow.
Getting to know Washington the man, says Constitution Center President David Eisner, involves honoring his accomplishments, but also acknowledging his human frailties.
He was insecure about his lack of education. He had a lazy eye that appeared to make him cross-eyed, and so he always looked at you sideways when you were in a room with him so that it appeared that his eyes were focusing on you.
Washington suffered from painful toothaches and eventually wore dentures made from a lead base fitted with human and cow teeth, as well as teeth made from elephant ivory. The dentures are featured prominently in this show, suspended in a glass case. Moral as well as physical problems plagued Washington. While he expressed a desire to see the end of slavery and made provisions in his will to free his slaves, over 300 slaves lived at Mount Vernon. The 9 enslaved people who were part of his household at the President's House in Philadelphia are the focus of an exhibition of art quilts co-hosted by the Constitution Center, the African American Museum, and the Visitor's Center called The President's House, Their Untold Story in Quilts. Michelle Flamer is the curator.
This show is not really intended to evoke anger, which it easily could do that, and I struggle with that in my own quilts that I've worked on, but the focus here is on those 9 enslaved Africans and treating them as individuals.
Individuals named Oney Judge, Mal, Austin, Hercules, Richmond, Giles, Paris, Christopher Shields, and Joe Richardson. Artist Susan Levering worked on 2 squares of a collaborative quilt called Whispering Walls. Each of its 9 squares represent 1 person.
I did Giles, who was the wagon driver and escorted Washington on his tours of the North and the South. So I used a square that represented the wagon trail with a representation of fields of the South and trees of Pennsylvania, and it's quilted with a wagon wheel. And the other one that I did was Steeles, who was footman for Washington, and he was one who could actually write. And he had written and requested his freedom, and it was denied. And I used a very traditional square called Courthouse Steps to highlight the incongruency between what was justice and going on at the time and what he was allowed to live with.
Another quilter, costume designer Stephanie Ama Young, whose quilt, Flying Geese, Journey of Faith, is at the African American Museum, chose to represent the seamstress, Oney Judge, who made clothes for the Washingtons.
I felt a connection to her, and just thinking about what she had to do. What I do on a sewing machine, she's doing it by hand, and I'm in awe because I know how much time it takes. So she's making gowns, elaborate gowns that have to go over the big bustles and things that they wore, and it's not easy creating those shapes.
There was also a robust, free African population in Philadelphia, says curator Michelle Flamer. In creating her quilt, titled President's House, God, Geometry, and George, she thought about what it must have been like for those enslaved at the President's House, including the chief cook, Hercules.
I can just imagine as I stitch this quilt, Hercules going down to the dock and waiting for a shipment of spice or, you know, the fish that came in that day that was fresh that he would then take back to the kitchen and prepare, and how he mingled with other free people who looked just like him, but yet he was not free. Although he was free on Washington's birthday, he escaped on February 22nd.
Does learning about the darker side of heroes, the ways they fall short, undermine our national spirit? B.J. Dunn, Deputy Superintendent for Independence National Historical Park, believes it strengthens it.
As a society, we need to know all of the pieces of the stories that contributed to building of this great nation. And if you don't know the full story, then you can't appreciate it. That's what allows us to continue to shape our nation and where we're going.
George Washington, the general and president, became a legend in his lifetime. His leadership and values helped shape the nation. George Washington, the man, was both noble and flawed, as was the young country he helped to found. But perhaps the enduring gift a hero can give us is insight into his and our own humanity. That despite his and our flaws, we might be stimulated by his ideals, be made wiser by his mistakes, and be stirred to make a difference in our own time.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Discover the real George Washington. New Views from Mount Vernon is at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia. The President's House, The Untold Story in Quilts is at the Constitution Center, the Visitor Center, and the African American Museum, and both shows run through September 5th. Pennsylvania has been the birthplace of many iconic artists, like the 19th century realist Thomas Aikens, the 20th century furniture maker and sculptor Wharton Esherick, and the late Andrew Wyeth. However, mention William T. Trigo and you'll likely be met with blank stares, though he has since been forgotten by many. The Bucks County native was once internationally lauded for his paintings of military conflicts. Now WRTI's Eric Brannan takes us to the Michener Museum in Doylestown for So Bravely and So Well, the first ever retrospective of the artist's work.
William Trigo was born in 1858, just 2.5 years before the outbreak of the Civil War. Though the war was over by the time he was 6 years old, the conflict had an indelible impact on him, capturing his young imagination. He spent the rest of his life painting not just the Civil War, but scenes from various conflicts in America and abroad. He became famous for his ability to capture the raw emotion of battle, as well as for his attention to detail, says Joseph Eckhart, curator of So Bravely and So Well.
He is trying to actually evoke a sense of being there. It's almost like a movie director setting up a scene, and if the viewer is going to appreciate that scene and experience that event, every detail has to be right. And there is a kind of a cinematic quality about some of his work.
The exhibition, which contains over 80 objects, is the first show ever dedicated solely to Trigo's art. Coinciding with the show is the release of a fully illustrated biography written by Joseph Eckhart, and an online catalog resume, a complete listing and description of all the artist's works. Candace Clark, executive assistant to the director at the Michener Museum, says the digital catalog will be permanent.
And our hope is that it will not get out of date, that we will keep adding images to it and works to it as we become aware of those works. And we're also hoping that it's going to be kind of a focal point for scholars and collectors about Trigo, and that will encourage people to share information.
While the art on its own warrants an exhibition, equally as impressive as the work William Trigo produced is his life story and the physical hardship he overcame. At around age 2, he was afflicted by an illness, most likely polio. Joseph Eckhart says this severely affected Trigo's physical condition for his entire life.
What we know is that his hands were, as one reporter put it, twisted all out of shape. His right hand was the worst. It was bent back underneath of his wrist. The fingers were all curled up tight. It couldn't be moved. What movement he had was in the thumb and forefinger on the left hand. And so he would pick up the brush in those two fingers and then wedge it in among the frozen fingers on his right hand. And then he would use the left hand to push the right hand back and forth across the canvas, sometimes moving his entire body to make a brush stroke.
In addition to his difficulties with his hands, Trigo's mobility was limited, and he required assistance with many of his day-to-day activities. Yet his physical setbacks may have helped to spark his early creative impulses.
I suspect in the aftermath of the war, there were a lot of little boys who acted out their Civil War fantasies, acted out stories that their uncles or grandfathers had told them. Trigo, of course, couldn't do that. You know, he could hardly move. And so his way of processing the information was to put it on paper. Where the other kids could go out and, you know, pretend they were leading a cavalry charge, he drew the cavalry charge.
Trigo's father, Jonathan, a successful artist himself who had studied under famed American portrait painter Thomas Sully, was quick to notice his son's raw talent and trained him as a painter. At age 20, William's first historical painting, The Charge of Custer at Winchester, won an award at the Michigan State Fair in Detroit, garnering critical and public praise. With the proceeds of the sale of that work, Trigo enrolled himself at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, a major turning point in his life.
At that point, he's leaving his father's training. His father's taught him everything he can possibly teach him. He goes on to the next step, onto the Pennsylvania Academy, which in those days was as good as it got. You know, to go study at the Pennsylvania Academy of Philadelphia was the ultimate experience for an aspiring artist.
During Trigo's time at the Academy, he was taught by Thomas Aikens. However, Aikens didn't pay him much attention.
Aikens was difficult to deal with. There's a story of Aikens sitting in front of his students' paintings and just staring at them for 15 minutes, and then he would get up and walk away and never say a word. Trigo himself said in a letter years later that he survived, quote, the neglect and sarcasm of Aikens. So I suspect that he didn't have a good experience with Aikens.
While still at the Academy in 1883, Trigo completed what is probably his most recognizable work, The March to Valley Forge, a 6x3-foot oil on canvas portraying General George Washington watching over a procession of troops in harsh winter conditions. The painting was also a source of controversy. Trigo entered it into a competition at the Academy for which the first prize was $3,000, about $50,000 today. However, despite the fact that the judges decided Trigo's work was the best, they ruled that none of the paintings submitted were good enough to win the prize.
So they said, yours is the best, you get the third prize, it's a silver medal, congratulations. And when they didn't reward him with what he thought he deserved, the first prize, he sued them. So he actually sued the Pennsylvania Academy. And it was a great scandal, enough that it made the New York Times. It went all the way to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and the Academy won in the end.
Despite losing the lawsuit, the publicity from the scandal made the next few years Trigo's most commercially successful. In 1884, he moved back in with his family, who'd relocated to North Wales in suburban Philadelphia. Working alongside his father, Trigo was so productive that in 1887, he was able to finance a trip to Paris and enroll in a prestigious academy. Trigo successfully acclimated to French tastes and had paintings selected to be in the Paris Salon twice during his three-year stay. His depictions of French soldiers bravely charging into battle earned plaudits from French critics, and even comparisons with their beloved Edouard de Taille.
And to pick out this young American studying in Paris and say, he's the rival of our great painter, that's the ultimate compliment.
Everything seemed like it was going right for William Trigo. He was a commercial and critical success in America as well as France, and he'd even found love. He met a young woman in Paris and proposed. She said yes, and they boarded a ship to America with plans to get married when they arrived.
But halfway across the Atlantic Ocean, she took a great liking to another young man on board the ship, and they were married, as it turned out. So Trigo's engagement, his romance, came to an end on the high seas, crossing over from France. He was so despondent that the captain ordered the crew to keep an eye on him. They were actually afraid he was going to climb over the rail and kill himself. And it's almost like that's the dividing line of his life.
When Trigo arrived home in 1890, he had more problems than just his broken heart. Interest in military painting was waning, and his time spent overseas had cost him his commercial momentum in the U.S. He had moved back in with his father and stepmother in North Wales, but struggled to find work. He was denied a teaching position at the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, and in an effort to stay afloat financially, he began painting subjects outside of his area of expertise.
He begins to paint genre paintings, portraits, cats, the neighbor's cows, whatever, you know, whatever they want painted. He begins to look for illustration jobs, which is something he didn't really want to do, but he knew that if he could get into that profession, it would be steady work.
He was never really able to tap into that market, though. After the death of his father in 1901 and stepmother in 1906, with financial problems growing and his physical setbacks impossible to manage on his own, Trigo was running out of options. Extended family in Massachusetts had arranged for Trigo to stay with them, but on the day he was scheduled to leave, he took his own life. William Trigo the man was quickly forgotten, but his legacy remained. Since his death, not a decade has passed without one of his works being reproduced in print. Now, with the retrospective of his career and the release of Joseph Eckhart's biography, Trigo can be remembered not just for his visually stunning paintings, but also for his character. He was a fiercely devoted artist who worked against adversity throughout his entire life. And despite how that life ended, Trigo's story stands as a testament to what can be accomplished with great talent and the endurance of the human spirit.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. So bravely and so well, the life and art of William T. Trigo is at the Michener Museum through October 2nd. Joseph Eckhart's biography of the same name is published by the University of Pennsylvania Press. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony in C under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannon is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.